For WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're bringing the highlights from a panel hosted at WHQR and organized by Good Shepherd Center. I moderated the panel and wrote an intro for it, so let's just jump straight in. Today we're taking inspiration from this recent book, There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America by Brian Goldstone. The book focuses on five families in Atlanta who find themselves without safe, secure, reliable housing. The instability of their precarious housing impacts their work, their children's education, and their mental and physical well-being. And all of this happens as they continue to work for a paycheck that doesn't stretch far enough to cover their rent. While this book is focused on the realities of homelessness in Atlanta, make no mistake, this crisis is happening here in the Cape Fear region as well. New Hanover County alone saw more than 4,000 evictions filed in the last fiscal year, the most of any year on record. Our point-in-time count for the region showed 506 people experiencing homelessness, but this is certainly an undercount. As discussed in Goldstone's book, only those living in shelters or on the street are counted in that tally. Looking at the school district, we get a clearer picture. Under a broader definition of homelessness, there were more than 1,100 homeless students in New Hanover County alone in 2023. That's one in every 25 students enrolled in New Hanover County schools. Imagine one student in every classroom living in unstable housing. And that's not accounting for their parents, or for adults who don't have children, are living in the same conditions, or anybody who's hiding their situation from the school district for fear that they might lose their children. So many of these folks are working while living in desperate conditions. These are not your stereotypes of a person living in the street. They're your neighbors, those serving you at a local restaurant, talking to you at your doctor's office, or cleaning your local school. We have a terrific panel of guests today who can speak to these experiences, the evictions and the low wages that lead to them, and what solutions we can consider. First, I'd like to welcome Tyrone Garrett, the CEO of the Wilmington Housing Authority. Mr. Garrett brings two decades of experience in affordable housing and community development. Since joining WHA, he's moved to leverage private investment to rehab and rebuild multiple properties and will bring additional badly needed affordable units online. Next, Suzanne Biagini, a social worker with New Hanover County Schools. Suzanne has worked for two decades for the school district and previously came from the county's Department of Social Services. Next, I'd like to welcome Mary. Mary is a working mother who is here to share the powerful perspective of someone who has been homeless despite having a job. After leaving a domestic violence situation, she spent 2 years working at a medical office while quietly navigating homelessness, moving between friends and family members' homes when no landlord would rent to her. I'm thrilled to say that Mary is now securely housed, giving her 4-year-old son a safe place, a stable place to call home. And finally, I'd like to welcome Katrina Knight, Executive Director of Good Shepherd Center. Katrina has led Good Shepherd for more than 20 years. She's expanded the organization from an emergency shelter to case management, rehousing, permanent housing, and more. And as a housing reporter, she is first on my speed dial for amazing insights and perspective on housing. So welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'd like to start by having everyone say a little bit about why this topic matters to you and why you're interested in being part of this conversation today. If you'd like to start, Katrina.
Sure. It's only fair. It was my idea.
Yeah.
You know, we spend so much time, I think, trying to counter what the average person thinks about, you know, who is homeless, who is in housing crisis. And the number one reason that people find themselves literally homeless is economic in nature. It's not primarily mental illness. It's not primarily substance abuse. It's not primarily any number of different issues that somebody might, you know, weather in a season of their life. It is primarily economic. It's that mismatch that I hope we all are aware of at this point in this community. It's that mismatch of what people earn and what they need to earn in order to afford housing and hold on to it. And so Good Shepherd has always met that smaller group of people who find themselves unable to hold on to housing and don't have family to lean on, don't have savings or what have you. But we're in this conversation now, inspired by that book, because there are literally thousands of additional neighbors who you're not going to see on the street, we're not going to meet at Good Shepherd, but who are doubled up, overcrowded, quite literally in housing crisis, but not recognized as homeless.
Mary?
I think it's very imperative that a lot of people know that for you to be homeless doesn't mean you have to be on a corner. Doesn't mean that you have to look the part. I went to work every single day and did what I could for my son. I worked every single day because I had to. But that doesn't mean that I looked homeless. None of my patients knew that. It was just something that happened, and it was up to me to make the decision to change it. And for 2 years, 2 months, and 10 days, I stood homeless with my son. And guess what? Now we have a place to be able to call our own. I just got my apartment listing 2 months ago. So I don't know what the image of homeless looks like. That doesn't make any sense to me. Just because it could be anybody. Exactly what you said earlier. Could be the people at your doctor's office, people who wait on you, people who are givers to the community. And we still have to do what we have to do and struggle, but you don't have to look homeless. I don't think that's a thing.
I'm gonna echo it. I think it's so important to expand people's perspective. I think most of us live in our world, and that doesn't have to be a negative thing. You kind of know your world. But as a person who works in the school system and you hear these numbers, I just don't think you understand the way that this all plays out for children whose homes are not the same every single night. They go from a different place to a different place to a different place. And I think it's important that we recognize the humanity in those children and those families and provide them a place. And so having that conversation to understand the systems that impact all of that, will help those children and their education and hopefully down the line for future generations.
For me, as stated, I've been in the public housing sphere and government since 1996. And what I've seen over the years is, you know, a movement towards, you know, making strong attempts in society and in communities to try and help defray homelessness and the struggles that people actually go through. But how do we do more? And what mechanisms can we create, and what synergy can we create among all of ourselves and all the organizations that work together, that you see working together, to try and alleviate the stress and the strain that is put on the community. For me, working with a housing authority, we are a government agency, but we have a philanthropic mission, so to speak, by trying to provide opportunities for affordable housing. But again, we're constrained. We only receive government federal funding. So when the government shuts down, that puts us in a tough spot, right? To be able to provide the necessary resources. Like, we weren't able to issue any vouchers during the shutdown because we were too concerned that we would oversubscribe and not be able to support everyone. So I know people look to the federal government or look to a housing authority such as the Wilmington agency here to do everything. But we're not in that position. We want to. I would love to be able to do that on behalf of everyone. But we need help just like the residents and the community need help.
Katrina, I know that we had talked the other day about some of the folks who come to Good Shepherd mm-hmm. or who need meals, who need assistance in various ways. Can you talk about who comes through your doors?
Well, Good Shepherd really serves the whole breadth of people who find themselves without housing. So we've always had, because we are considered a wet shelter, if you will, so we do engage or accept people who are in active addiction, for example, who have severe and persistent mental illness. Sometimes it can feel like we fit the stereotype because we have some very vulnerable people in the mix. But we also have that two-parent family where, you know, dad lost his job and they need to stay with us until dad finds a new job. A veteran who, you know, is reluctant to access resources from the VA but is eligible for some things. It is really the whole span of folks, from newborns straight from the hospital with their parents to a 93-year-old whose family drops him on the lawn and leaves him with us because they just are kind of at the end of what they feel able to do for him. So it's really the whole range of folks. And we're not going to meet the average person in housing crisis. We're not going to meet everyone or the average person who loses their housing. Most people are going to find a way to kind of self-resolve or be homeless, but not under that HUD definition that the book talked about. You know, they're going to be the hidden homeless. They're going to be the people who are doubled up or overcrowded with someone else, where honestly, that's two households in crisis usually, and maybe jeopardizing the housing of the host family. We're only going to meet those folks when that situation falls apart. Until then, we don't see them. Ironically, I go to the doctor's office where Mary works, and so I probably was one of those people interacting with her, completely oblivious myself that she was in housing crisis. I would never have known that. And so you don't realize the struggles that people are experiencing. I know I can't go to any restaurant, any store, any lumber yard without encountering somebody who has come to Good Shepherd before. But beyond that, as the book said, possibly six times the number of literally homeless are the working households who are in a housing crisis, who are just invisible to us.
Can I just say that, and it may be a little off topic, but not only are families struggling, you know, with homelessness, they're making decisions what they will pay in their household. Whether or not it will be a roof over their head, or will it be a refrigerator full of groceries for the whole entire month. So people are struggling that we don't know about, or that you would not know about, or that I may not know about in their lives, within their families, and they're making these tough decisions. Now, I was raised always keep a roof over your head, right? Mm-hmm. That's the first thing that you do. But then if you do that and you're economically challenged in your family, you're working, but you're still struggling, what do you forsake, right? What do you not do? What do you do? You not put gas in your vehicle to keep the roof over your head, because that's the struggle. That's the budgetary decision that you have to make that particular week. For me, having been around this for so long, those are the, I don't make any assumptions. I just, and I probably make the other assumption based on today's time and the world that we live in, that someone is struggling. When I see them, I automatically think that they're in a position that they probably could use some assistance or some type of help, not knowing what it might be. But that's really the way I look at it more than anything else.
I wanted to just add, in a school setting, in an elementary school setting, that looks like the child who's been late to school every single day, maybe just 10 minutes, still late. They're accumulating tardies, but it's because mom got off of her shift at 7 a.m., maybe the person she has helping her provide care for her child isn't going to get up, or maybe it's an older sibling that has to get on the bus. So they're coming in late all the time. And your first response is to go, irresponsible, doesn't value education, but they're just getting off work. Or maybe it's the parent who you're finding it really difficult to schedule a school conference for, and the teacher comes to me because they're like, I can't reach them. You know, can you try? I have a more flexible schedule so I can do that. And I'm finding out they're working 60 hours a week. And it's not that school meeting isn't a priority or being there. It's just the time, having to make that decision. What's the balance there? And so having that conversation with people is what we've all said, is trying to have that perspective to figure out what's actually going on. You see a behavior, but behind that behavior, you can't assume malicious intent or apathy.
I want to jump off of what you said, Mr. Garrett, because you are so right that this is a really common problem in our community. Even beyond the working homeless, more than 50% of renters in this community are considered housing cost burdened, meaning more than 30% of their income is going towards the cost of housing. And that means that you have to make really challenging decisions about whether you're going to pay for daycare, whether you're going to pay for groceries, whether you're going to pay for medications that you need, or if you're going to pay for your housing. And I see that this has made you emotional, Mary, and I'm curious if there's anything that this is pulling up for you, decisions that you had to make that were really trying.
Yes, absolutely. When I first got my job, I literally less than 3 days had just came out of a DV shelter. And at the time, my son was about to be three. I have a kid. My son's autistic. He has special needs, so I know he has social workers. I have people who are involved in him. But as much resources as they talk about and being available, I had to make the decision if I wanted to get help or if I wanted to jeopardize the fact that I may lose my son because I didn't have stable housing for him. I didn't have anywhere to go. And it wasn't because of any decision I made. I really feel like in Wilmington and just any and everywhere, it's very imperative that they have certain clauses that protect families and I would say women, especially in DV situations, because the reason why I got my eviction was because there wasn't a clause in my lease to protect me for domestic violence situations. Was I the leaseholder? Absolutely not. I was a lease occupant. But because I was over the age of 18 and I resided in that apartment, I had an eviction on my record. Was that a decision I made? No. I had to protect me and my son. But because of that, it sent waves of everything else I wanted to accomplish.
I want to ask about how that eviction impacted you, because it seems like it just made this so much harder.
Absolutely. And again, I feel like that clause, I believe it's called WAWA or VAWA or VAWA. Something like, yes. That clause within the lease protects, God forbid, if there's an emergency situation with a woman and she has children, or just in a domestic violence situation, period, with or without children. If, God forbid, anything happens when you're in a DV situation, you are able to break your lease or be able to leave that apartment without no financial repercussions. And unfortunately, the apartment that I had with my son's father didn't have that clause. And that's how I got my eviction. Did anyone want to listen to what I went through? Was that something I wanted to talk about? Not really. But transparently speaking, those were the cards that I got dealt with. I had to bite the bullet, figure it out, and lug it with my son.
I was going to say the acronym is VAWA. It's violence against women. Mm-hmm. So that's a clause that many landlords should use.
Absolutely.
The housing authority has it in our lease, that we can offer assistance to a woman or a family. And VAWA works two ways, I have to tell everyone. It does work both ways. But if someone comes into that type of situation, we can assist them as best as we can to find another unit for them or give them some other type of support.
It sounds like this isn't required by the state, though,
or
by the city.
Doesn't seem to be. No. Federal properties that have federal funds flowing through. Yes, definitely.
And that's what I wanted to piggyback off of, because it's very important. I really feel like that clause protects so many people, like especially in my situation. Once I left him and I had to go into a domestic violence shelter, I got my job at the doctor's office. It was game time after that. But guess what? Nobody cared about that. My doctor was very, very amazing to me. And it wasn't until like my second day there, I had to be honest with her and tell her what I was going through, because I didn't have the clothes to come in every single day dressed in scrubs. I came in there clean every single day. I sent my son to daycare clean every single day. But guess what? Until my money started flowing in, I had to figure it out. But without that clause, it definitely sets the tone with a whole bunch of different other situations. And I'm grateful to say, Starway Village does have that clause. I signed my lease very happily.
I was going to say, I think the misconception is spot on with Mary saying. I think people assume you made one catastrophic choice.
Literally.
And most of the folks that I encounter and families that I encounter, they're operating on slim margins or thin margins. Yeah. And it's the book said, a death by 1,000 cuts. Like, it may not be one decision, but it's a decision, a choice, an experience, something, a death, an illness. Again, conversations, a lot of families, they don't get paid time off.
Mm-hmm.
They don't work.
Yeah.
They go home early on that shift. They know they have 3 hours that they're going to have to make up by removing, maybe it was a day at the park with their kid and a special dinner, or they're going to have to trade that time somewhere where, in my job, if I don't go to work, I have a paid day off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so I think those margins are often slim and we don't realize it. And I think, we don't realize the emotional impact that has for somebody, again, in my position, when somebody comes to me and discloses a vulnerability, like that has a big emotional impact on somebody. That's a humbling experience. That's a vulnerable experience. And I don't think people realize what somebody brings with them when they share it with a social worker. There can be fear because they're afraid, if I tell you this, are you going to call social services? And now I'm going to lose something else that I'm already just struggling to maintain a hold on.
Or imagine having to tell your story
to
every landlord.
Transparently speaking, I think I had said this to someone right before I came up here. The only reason why I was okay with talking about this today is because it's over. It's over. If I still would be struggling with my son, I wouldn't be up here.
I know we're centering on homelessness, but just affordability across the board for many people, there's a stereotype that is cast upon families who need subsidy or need assistance. People believe that those individuals don't work, that they're uneducated, but it's not the case. You know, when they cast that stereotype over, you know, I'm a stereotype, right? Single mother. My mother, you know, she did as much as she possibly could, worked two jobs to send me to school. But we still struggled, right? And so if there was assistance that was necessary or needed, my mother took advantage of it for me. But so when people talk about stereotypes, I can raise my hand and say I am one, right? But people don't see me like that. I'm here. I'm speaking to you about what we do, but you would never know that. And so individuals who are needing of support get put into a box and cast, you know, chastised or whatever, because people believe that they're not trying. They're, you know, the pull yourself up by the bootstraps analogy. Well, they are, but this might be taking them a little more time than someone else who's been a little more fortunate in life. So that stereotype kind of prevents some people from advancing as quickly as they possibly can, especially in the world of trying to find a unit, housing, and stability for their families.
That was Tyrone Garrett, the CEO of Wilmington Housing Authority. I'm Kelly Knoyer. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. This is The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks for staying with us. Today, we have a highlight from a panel put on by Good Shepherd Center discussing the issue of invisible homelessness and what leads people to be homeless even if they have stable employment. Our guests are Katrina Knight, the executive director of Good Shepherd Center, Tyrone Garrett, the CEO of the Wilmington Housing Authority, Mary, who recently got out of homelessness after more than 2 years of instability with her toddler, and Suzanne Biagini, a social worker with New Hanover County Schools. Let's jump back in with a question from me and an answer from Biagini.
Were there other factors that you've seen that tend to push people towards housing instability?
I can speak to just the broad idea that there's an assumption that systems play nicely together. That systems, whether they're federal, state, local, charitable organizations that have excellent hearts behind them that I think want to embrace the humanity of people, the reality that as a lot of these systems, they just don't play nice together. You can apply for this, but then you got to go on a waiting list for this. Or in terms of the definitions, the book highlighted the definition of homeless was kind of using the idea of like you have to be literally in a car or on the street, where from a federal perspective of homelessness, when it comes to McKinney-Vento for students and their families, it's a different definition, which is a great definition. It's a better definition, personally. But you assume that these systems are there to protect people, and they overlap each other, and they compete against each other. And then to ask a person who's already feeling like they're drowning to navigate 20 different systems using that system's language, I think it just gets disheartening and frustrating. And then you just consider this process. And so I think in our county, there's a lot of great systems, but sometimes they don't play nice together.
Yes.
For the Wilmington Housing Authority, I think what we face is our waiting list, right? We have over 1,500 people or families that are on our waiting list that we're unable to provide a housing choice voucher for and or a hard unit within our portfolio. And that's not because we don't want to offer the voucher. It's not because we don't want to offer the unit. We just don't have it available to do so. Everyone believes that when you talk about the housing choice voucher, we're talking about an actual ticket, right? An actual item like this that we hand out to individuals. But that's not what actually housing choice vouchers, that's not what it actually is. It is a funding source. And from that funding source, you can't make a clear division of saying, we're going to divide this $1 million into 20 vouchers or 30 vouchers or whatever the number is, because the market is fluctuating. The number, mm-hmm. the bedroom sizes that we offer are different. So that means the cost on that lease amount is going to be different. That landlord may be charging one thing, and we're able to pay something a little bit lower. But then there's another landlord with a 4-bedroom that we have to pay more for to help a family. So it's not a straight 100 vouchers that the housing authority has, they offer. It is a bottom line dollar amount that we have to ensure that we're able to fund on a, not only on a daily basis for a resident, but on a monthly and annual and actually a 15-year basis for most residents and most families if we have a HAP contract attached to it. So I can't just say I want to issue 100 vouchers today and not worry about, will I have the funding next month? Will I have the funding in 5 years to continue to support these 100 families that we have in place right now? Those are things that I have to consider. And it's an unknown and moving target for us.
You know, we talk about the rising cost of living. It's more than anything that's driven by the cost of housing in our community. And the rule of thumb for decades has been that no one of us, in this room included, should be spending more than 30% of our income on housing. I don't know if I have very many peers who can live up to that anymore, where maybe 10 or 20 years ago we could, but that's your rent, your mortgage, your utilities, your insurance, all the things. And it sounds great, because if you're only spending 30% on your housing, then it stands to reason you would have 70% left for all the other things, the medications, your transportation, recreation, you know, all the other things that it takes to have a quality of life. We have always met people who, in order to secure housing, have had to expend 50% of their income, 75% of their income. I have met families where, when you really get into it, they were spending 90% of their take-home pay just on their rent and utilities. And so I don't think it's surprising that that math is not going to hold up over time. At some point, we all experience a car breakdown, an unexpected illness, hospitalization, what is an inconvenience for many of us, where you pull out a credit card or you take a loan from a family member, or it's a temporary setback. For people who don't have savings, for people who don't have family to fall back on, those little things snowballing into an eviction. And so when I think about why do people become homeless, we will often hear, well, you know, it's because that my car broke down and I couldn't get to work anymore, or there was a hospitalization. But when you go back far enough, it's because to start with, there was too much being laid out on housing and it crowded out everything else.
I'm so glad that you mentioned earlier the competing definitions of McKinney-Vento, that's under the Department of Education, it's how school systems define homelessness, versus the way that housing and urban development defines it. So we're talking about completely different definitions. One of them is literally homeless in the streets, the other is going to encapsulate a lot more of those invisible homeless situations. But what I'm curious about is where the gaps are and where we're failing to fill in those resources. In the book, it was a really prominent part of some of their journeys that they would go to the center and they would try and get this definition of homelessness. And because they were fighting desperately to stay in a hotel to keep a roof over their kids' heads, they didn't count. They did not count. And so there was nothing available to help them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious if that's a situation that we see happening in the Cape Fear region the same way, or if we're doing a little bit better of a job than Atlanta. How do we compare?
For Good Shepherd's purposes, when you receive federal, or honestly for us, even if you receive state funding that originates with HUD also, so it's still HUD funding, we are not to shelter someone who is not literally homeless. And so it's not unusual for someone to come in to do an intake and say, well, I have been living with my sister, but I know that that's jeopardizing my sister's maybe housing authority unit or other rental that she has, and things are becoming tense. I think she's told me the first of the month, I and my child need to be out. And so we can sort of anticipate that and plan for that and try to make space for that family to come in. Right now we are in a separate difficult situation where we are running a wait list for every population, whether you are a single gentleman, a single woman, or a family with children. But to Suzanne's point, literal homelessness in terms of the HUD definition. You are on the street, you're sleeping in your car, mm-hmm. you are in a place not meant for human habitation. And so families, working people who are doubled up or overcrowded to us are sort of the hidden homeless. In our work, they would be considered at risk mm-hmm. or nearly homeless, but not yet homeless, if that makes sense.
I have a question here about resource gaps, but I'm hearing that there's gaps at every level. There's not enough. We can't provide the housing vouchers necessary for mm-hmm. the 1,500 people on the wait list.
Correct.
There's a wait list for every kind of demographic that needs shelter. And we know that there are people who are not being served by any of these systems mm-hmm. because they're doubled up. And I know that there's not enough rental assistance or gap financing available for those folks. Is there anywhere we're meeting demand?
Absolutely not. And I can go back to what Ms. Katrina said about actually having the little definition of homelessness. In my situation, I did not have a place that I can stay for too long. I did have a place maybe for a week or two. Then after that, I had to go somewhere else. But at the same time, that puts me in a situation where, so because I'm not on the streets, or if I did spend a night or two in my car, can I genuinely ask for assistance? Not only is there a wait list, but there's also the possibility of losing what I'm working so hard for, and that's my child.
I think there are resources to be had, but again, for me, it goes back to the system that operates that resource and the regulations or the rules, which I think, like Katrina said, can have purpose to have definitions so we can square it away. But when you have too many regulations and too many rules, I think you lose the humanness mm-hmm. of the people that you're trying to help. And whenever I'm encountering a family, and again, for purposes of my job, I'm using a McKinney-Vento definition. And for me to incorporate humanness and the humanity in a person, especially as a parent who loves their child, I just don't believe to my core people are out there to harm their children. And I'll say to the parent, I hope that I say it every single time. My intentions are to always say it like, hey, just so you know, just be honest with me because I want your baby to stay here. You are not a burden. This is not a burden. So if I can take that on and keep your child in a stable school, provide transportation so that you can go and work and do you, that creates humanity and connection. Because when these systems and the regulations happen, I've seen it 100 times, maybe Mary, everybody could probably speak to it, or if you've encountered this, is sometimes what happens is people manipulate the system.
Yes.
And in the book, she talked about, one of the women talked about meeting with the person, and a friend had said like, oh, but if you tell them, mm-hmm. say this sentence, then you will meet the definition. And I can't be upset with somebody who I call manipulates the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But when you manipulate the situation, you have now unintentionally created mistrust in your relationship. You now don't necessarily trust the system that you're relying on to help you, and that system might not trust that you're being honest. And those are the gaps that I see, like the regulations and then the humanness that sometimes gets lost unintentionally.
It's so crazy because I know people who are, you know, who have housing, who get government assistance, who get everything they need, and they do nothing. They do nothing. But then there's working parents who are struggling to meet ends meet. And no, we can't get any government assistance. In my situation, according to DSS, I had no bills, so I should be able to afford everything. They wouldn't include my car payment, insurance, cell phone bill, spring a storage bill. I had to pay for my son's daycare because I couldn't get any assistance regarding that. I have no bills. I still have to pay for food. I have no bills. What am I to do for my son? So it's like, I really feel like there needs to be a change way deeper within just housing. Like, housing sets the tone for every other program that's out there, because without housing, you can't have this or that. but with housing, you can't have this or that. So either way you look at it, you have people who bust their butt every day to get to work to make sure that they provide for themselves and their family, but then they're the ones who struggle the most with no type of assistance.
Housing is a stability for everything. And what I mean by that is there are individuals who need medical care. But if you're not stable in your housing environment, you're unable to receive the proper medical care because, you know, a physician can't reach you on a regular basis. Or you cannot, if you're couch surfing, you cannot get to your physician for treatment or whatever it may be because you may now be 3 miles out or 4 miles out without any transportation to get to your doctor's appointment. It impacts school, as we were just saying. A child may miss days at school, not because they want to, not because the parent doesn't want them to be in the system, but because they're moving around at a pace that doesn't allow them to be consistent. And so now that child is suffering and falling behind in the classroom. So, you know, housing is a stability for everything. It is the foundation. And with the housing authority, we're government, we're confined by government rules. So if someone were to come in and needed housing and let's say they did not tell us their full income, right? They held something back to make sure that they were okay. In a year, we'll find out because there's a system that we have to use to run everyone's social security number, which tells me if they've received any other income from someplace else. And when that pops up, I'm handcuffed. Mm-hmm. There's a rule that says I can't allow them to stay. Mm-hmm. And if I do allow them to stay, then there's an audit that says, ding, housing authority, you didn't do the right thing. We're going to make a decision about where you're going to be next year in terms of your scores or whether or not we're going to take funding from you. So we're trying to have as much empathy as we can. But on the backside, there's the possibility that trying to read that in between that gray could actually hurt other residents and other people we're trying to actually serve sometimes.
That was Tyrone Garrett, the CEO of Wilmington Housing Authority. I'm Kelly Knoyer. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. This is The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks for joining us. Today, we have a panel discussing the issue of invisible homelessness and what leads people to be homeless even if they have stable employment. The panel was put together as a reading group based on the book There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America.
I want to talk a bit about supply. This was such a big topic in Atlanta because gentrification was kind of the boogeyman of this book, displacing residents and replacing affordable apartments with shiny and completely unaffordable new buildings. Is that same process happening here in Wilmington? And what can be done to prevent displacement like that?
Wow, that's my question.
Great question.
Yeah, Tyrone, I want to see what you say, Tyrone, and then figure out what we'll say.
In all seriousness, with the Housing Authority, at least with our voucher program, what we're seeing is that there are landlords that are willing to allow for residents to utilize their voucher in their particular home. And then there are other landlords and other property owners who are not, meaning that if you go online, you'll see an abundance of units that are available, but they're not accepting the voucher. Mm-hmm. It's there, but they're not accepting a voucher. So then it's incumbent upon the Housing Authority to do outreach and try to encourage those individuals, those property owners to open themselves up to the voucher used by a family. And we're competing against fighting back and pushing back against the stereotype of what a voucher looks like, right? So right now we have 70 families that are looking for units. The other impact is that where are the units? We want to deconcentrate poverty. Mm-hmm. That was one of the biggest goals. So everyone shouldn't be, you know, all the lower income residents shouldn't be packed in all together. That was the idea of the voucher. But when you try to move them outside of those census tracts, what actually happens for us is they may need transportation and we don't have the biggest metropolitan transportation system here in Wilmington. So if someone does move 5 miles out or finds a unit, they're going to have trouble getting there or getting to work or doing some of the things that they need to do. In addition, security deposits are a problem. Like we're not allowed to give anyone funding for a security deposit. So if they find a unit and there's a security deposit of a month and a half, we don't have the ability to help them with that. They have to go to a third party, a social service agency that's in the city to try and offer that type of support. So there are these barriers that residents will come across. The last barrier that we see often, a unit is available. Landlord is making available for a housing choice voucher family, but it needs repairs. Just because a family is economically challenged does not mean that we're going to let them move into anything. So we have a really stringent inspection process where we'll ding you until you get it right. But what that does for a particular family trying to find a home is it puts them, 60 days outside of when they can actually move in. Or a landlord will say, you know what, I don't want to make all those repairs for this particular family, so I'm not going to be in the program.
Katrina, do you have thoughts that you'd like to share on supply as well?
Well, that question of how do you preserve or how do you improve neighborhoods and communities without displacing the folks who've been there for generations is something that I think as a community we continue to struggle with. I live in one of the most gentrifying neighborhoods in Wilmington, and so I see it, and I understand why my neighborhood is attractive to seniors and working professionals and young parents. But I also feel very protective of some of the elderly homeowners who, there's some deferred maintenance on their home and they don't have the wherewithal to make the improvements that they'd like to. And these are 100-year-old little bungalows. And so it's very tempting when a developer, waves a certain amount of money in front of them. But where do they go? I think we often lose them, not just from our neighborhood, but from the community. And if that's a win for them, that there's somewhere they're going to that makes them happy, then great. But I think there is something that is lost from the spirit of our neighborhood and our community. The city has a very little known program that would maybe work for some of my elderly neighbors, where either a low interest or no interest loan to repair their homes and bring it up to a more modern and efficient standard. Mm-hmm. If we were to invest more in that, that would I think help counter some of the gentrifying dynamics in some of our neighborhoods.
I do briefly want to talk about supply in terms of the actual number of units in this community, because there's been a lot of hay made about the housing gap. And I think that what a lot of us see is there's these new apartments that go up and they don't get filled very quickly because they are market rate housing and they're pretty expensive. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks who work regular jobs in this community, who work in the service industry, even nurses, firefighters, teachers, they actually can't afford some of those apartments. And so people assume, well, we have more apartments than we need. But the gap that we have in this community is actually at the lower range of the area median income. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really stands out to me, especially in recent years, is we're seeing these affordable housing projects get built, like Starway. And folks who are opposing these projects are saying, these aren't even affordable rents. Mm-hmm. You're saying this is 80% of the area median income. I can't afford this. This is higher than my mortgage. But what's happened is that there are people in this community who used to live in this community who've moved away because they cannot afford to live here anymore. And so the area median income, the average income a person makes in this community, has gone up. Not because the wages have gone up for folks in this community, but because people are moving out of town because they cannot afford to live here. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about supply, the supply that is affordable to somebody making the median income is fine. But if you don't make that, if you work at Bojangles, or if you work at McDonald's, or if you work for a doctor's office, you probably can't afford some of these new apartments that are going
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely.
And so they're sitting vacant. I know you love the musical chairs analogy, right, Katrina?
Do. Well, so there's another book that we encourage you to take a peek at, or there's a great presentation online that we can point you to. It's called Homelessness is a Housing Problem. And one of the authors joked that he was, one of the reviews was that he would make a terrible mystery writer. Homelessness is a housing problem, like it tells you in the title. So he and his co-author use an analogy of musical chairs, where there are 10 people, but only 9 chairs. And we're about to play musical chairs. Well, the 10th person is on crutches. So Steve has had an accident. Steve is on crutches. And so we begin to play musical chairs. Well, probably all of you would guess who's going to lose in that, right? And so if Steve is the one who doesn't get a chair and the other nine do, and we ask, well, why did Steve lose that? You know, we'll probably say, well, you know, he was on crutches. Of course he was not going to win that. Mm-hmm. But the point is, and the point that the authors make is, shouldn't there have been 10 chairs all along? If there had just been 10 chairs, it wouldn't have mattered that it took Steve longer to get to a chair. There would have been one available to him. If he's made to compete with the rest of us, he's going to lose out. I can't do justice to all that book points out, but they account for things like rates of substance abuse, rates of mental illness, and they're able to show that it really is about inventory. It really is about access, and we are currently in a community where we don't have enough chairs mm-hmm. for folks. The market is going to take care of people at a certain income level and above. The market, left to its own devices, is not going to take care of people who are only making $40,000 a year, $30,000 a year, $15 an hour. And to be a vibrant neighborhood, we need housing for people at all levels.
I want to talk about solutions because we want to figure out how to fix this problem, right? Mm-hmm. I want to know what doesn't work, and I want to know what does work.
I'm going to jump in first because I think I can answer it, and everyone else will have the harder part. collaboration is always going to work, right? I think that's always going to be the key solution to, or one of the solutions to some of the problems that we may have. Organizations working together, the public-private partnerships that we try to derive and try to create if your leadership is intentional. If you're intentional about what you're trying to accomplish, you can work with other organizations to get things done. The Housing Authority, for example, is willing to work with other nonprofits. There is no glory in taking ownership of everything, right? There, for us, the mission is to provide as much opportunity for housing that we possibly can, even if it's through another organization. So we don't have a problem in, if we have it, giving it to another organization that can get it up much sooner than we can. That works for us, and that's something that we've tried to do. So for me, a solution is always going to be collaborating with other organizations who have the same mission-driven approach.
I think I want to go off of what Ms. Suzanne said earlier about the programs. Like, just as much as programs that there is out there, I really feel like they don't work together. I really feel like there needs to be more of a structure with making sure that they all coincide with each other. If I live in one house and I have my place, why is it that I have to go to 7 different programs to try and get one type of assistance?
And I'll just piggyback on that because I agree with the collaboration and I agree with all that because I feel a lot in conversations with parents and my peers at work trying to build their perspective as educators, like, why do we have to continue to ask the right person the right question to get the right outcome? Mm-hmm. Why do sometimes services feel like we're gatekeeping them? And again, I really don't believe by design it's intentional. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of what happens when you have different systems, and that can be perhaps like we talk about eviction, and that's on your record. But in themes in the book, it also gets into credit scores, which some people would say it's kind of an antiquated system. Like, is a credit score really an indicator of if you can pay your bills? Like, in 2025, is that the best indicator? So can we change that system so that it plays nicely with a housing system who wants to know your, not just your eviction record, your credit score? And so I just really try to bring all of those pieces together. So for me, because I'm a social worker, I would go, we need more social workers. But we need good social workers. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to gatekeep resources. And you shouldn't have to ask the right person the right question to get the right outcome, especially when you're struggling. That's nobody wants that. Absolutely. The healthiest person with the most money, who's in the best mental health, doesn't want to have to navigate all of that mm-hmm. all the time.
That's all the time we have for the newsroom. Thank you to all my wonderful guests, Katrina Knight, Tyrone Garrett, Mary, and Suzanne Biagini. If you'd like to read the book this panel was based on, it's called There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America. It's by Brian Goldstone and is widely considered one of the best books of the year. I read it in preparation for this panel, and I highly recommend it. There was a lot of great stuff in this panel, and we couldn't fit it all into this show. So if you'd like to hear more from the Q&A section when we let the audience ask questions, you can find it at whqr.org. Our editor is Ben Schachman. Our programming director is Ken Campbell. If you missed a part of this program, you can find it at whqr.org or anywhere you get podcasts. If you have thoughts or comments about today's program or ideas for a future show, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.